Today, I sat down with Dr. Allison Bragger, and I have to say, this episode was really fun to record. Dr. Bragger is a neurobiologist with a remarkable portfolio of expertise in sleep and circadian rhythms. Currently serving active duty on the United States Army, Dr. Bragger also works with both human and animal models to explore the substrates and mechanisms of resiliency to extreme environmental stressors. Dr. Bragger's contributions to the field are not just within her research. She holds several leadership and service positions within various federal government agencies and university departments. Her insights have influenced fatigue management and neuroenhancement initiatives through collaborations with NATO, U.S. Special Operations Command, and the Office of the Army Surgeon General. Dr. Bragg has authored Military Training Doctrine on Holistic Health and co-authored the inaugural NCAA Student Athlete Mental Health Handbook. Her expertise is showcased through her role on the board of directors and her chairmanships within the Sleep Research Society and the Society for Research on Biological Rhythms. With numerous peer-reviewed publications in leading journals and a knack for communicating science to the public, Dr. Bragger has also made her mark as an author with her popular science book, Meathead: Unraveling the Athletic Brain. Today, we talk about groundbreaking research, her experiences, and her perspective on the vital relationship between sleep, health, and performance. One thing that a lot of people struggle with is very simple, sleep. Many of us pride ourselves on how much less sleep we got in high-stress environments, which should not be the case because we should be getting adequate amount of sleep to perform better in everyday life and show up as our best selves. So I'm really glad that this episode exists for everyone to check out and for everyone to listen to. So without further ado, let's dive into this enlightening conversation with Dr. Bragger. I hope you take away a lot from this episode and share with friends and family who you think may enjoy as well. Welcome to the longevity community. The future is bright. Let's get it. Dr. Bragger, welcome to the Longevity Podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day out here in North Carolina.
That's awesome. How would you describe what you do and why you're doing it?
So I really am an expert in human performance. Years ago, I wouldn't have called me an expert in human performance because I more or less focused on sleep. But over the years, I've recognized that, you know, my experience is being an athlete, professional athlete up until essentially last year. I retired from professional sport and now compete as a master's athlete. But I think that, you know, personal experience, living that lifestyle of an elite athlete has essentially been my passion and purpose behind my own research. One of my mentors, my gymnastics coach in high school, she always told us to always plan your career around your lifestyle, not your lifestyle around your career. And I really feel like I've mastered that. At the end of the day, I value being an athlete, but I also value coaching athletes. So that's more or less my ethos and my philosophy for how I do my own work now as a researcher, and especially a researcher within the military. So, you know, thinking of my soldiers as athletes, and coaching them through their own careers and in life.
How difficult, I must ask, was it to follow that philosophy? How difficult was it to tie in what it was that you loved and what you wanted to do as a career?
That's funny. So I guess the blunt answer to that is that's the reason why I left academia. And I started working for the government, because a lot of academic research is not centered around people. It's centered around problems and solving problems. I was always highly criticized, highly judged by faculty, colleagues, mentors of mine who thought I wasn't putting enough into my science because I chose to be a professional athlete on the side. But the irony being is I had more publications than them. I had more prestigious publications than them. I was always funding my own research. Like, it was a weird dynamic. And then when I had that unsuccessful job search in academia, that's when I really sat back and I was like, man, my values and my passions don't align with academia. Like, it's not them. They just see that I'm not cut out for it because I don't align with who they are. But I found my tribe. I found my people in the military. And again, I think it just goes back to that lifestyle thing. Is, you know, I still at the end of the day identify as an athlete first, like an athlete of life. And I really feel like being in the military is like back being a college athlete, where we eat together, we train together, we have fellowship together. It's all about being on a team and being with your teammates 24/7.
How would you summarize your academic journey so far?
It is very different, right? Because I started out the traditional road. I have a PhD in biology. Area of focus is in neuroscience and the genetics of sleep. So I went down that path, you know, got my PhD, did the postdoc thing. And in fact, I did two postdocs, the second one with the military, had my own funding consecutively from the NIH since graduate school. So essentially I was paying my own salary and paying for some of my research. And now more or less I'm a leader and I guess you could say program manager of science. So I manage a lot of money and a lot of science portfolios. So it's less about me being in the lab and doing the assays. It's more about recruiting the best teams and having these dream teams complete the work for me. You know, really, again, I see myself as sort of like the head coach of it all, where I recruit the best and people who are passionate about what they do. And I don't micromanage them. I give them a vision and they execute, and it's worked out. So, and we, you know, we try to have a lot of fun doing it too.
Absolutely. I think that's a very good truth. I'm only an undergraduate student at this point, but I've noticed ever since my involvement with research in oncology, I've noticed that it really makes a difference who you work with and how you work with them. You know, one of my mentors, she is absolutely the best teacher I know. She's very patient and she prides herself on challenging people and bringing people up and making sure that they work with each other and not against each other.
You know, I feel like you've got a great mentor and you need to hold on to her, because one of the weird things about academia is people take pride in the fact that they pit people against each other on projects and see who innovates or who completes it first. And I understand, like, science needs to be innovative and accelerate at the speed of relevancy. But there's better ways to do it than to pit people against each other. And so I just always find it odd, because you'll hear about that. Like, some of the best researchers in my own field, like, will brag about how they pit postdocs against each other to see who does it first and who does it better. And then the community, like, embraces it. And, you know, that's honestly, that's not how we do research in the military. It's all super collaborative. It's the opposite of what people think. Like, yeah, sure, we welcome competition, but we're competing against ourselves, not
against ourselves. Healthy competition, I like to call it. All right. Your expertise is in sleep and peak performance. How would you currently explain what we understand about why we as human beings sleep?
So I always like to believe in the more we learn, the less we know. You know, that's one thing one of my dearest coaches always just tell me. So we know sleep is important for longevity, right? The full reason behind this podcast. We know sleep is absolutely necessary and sufficient for a daily sustained life, right? If you don't sleep, you die. And that's not an exaggeration. We examined this in animal models, even if there were some flaws with those studies. But we all know, you know, from personal experience what sleep deprivation does. I think what we know less is the recovery process of sleep. So, you know, there's 90% of sleep research efforts have been focused on the consequences of sleep deprivation. And not to say that's not important, but very little research has been focused on the recovery aspect of sleep. And how quickly can one recover lost sleep given their circumstance? And what are the underlying biological, genetic, physiological factors that feed into that? That's really where the money is, because, and you know, that's essentially what we kind of do in the military, right? Is we want people who we call resilient to sleep deprivation, meaning under conditions of lost sleep, they perform better, but then they also rapidly replenish their need for sleep very quickly. That, I think, needs to be more of the focus is, okay, what do you do after sleep deprivation? not what do you do during? Because we kind of know that. And actually, what's really funny is a few years ago, we had a journal club when I was stationed at Walter Reed, and we read essentially the first sleep deprivation study ever done, which was conducted in 1896 by these researchers at the university. I can't remember if it was Iowa or Cornell. But bottom line being is they had eight individuals in their study. And in 1896, DNA wasn't discovered yet. We knew very little about biology, very little about physiology. And yet their findings in 1896 directly align with what we know today in 2024. And not to, you know, dismiss the amazing medical advancements and integration of advanced medical technologies like neuroimaging that have, you know, further elucidated these mechanisms. But again, we know so much about sleep deprivation and we know so little about the recovery process.
Are there any surprises? I mean, sleep, it seems so simple. You close your eyes and you're gone. And you're talking about a study that was done in the 1800s, and they know things that we currently know as well. So would you say there's something new to discover within the realm of sleep?
Yeah, and I think that's where the advancements in genomics and like understanding what the consequences of sleep deprivation are down to the level of the cell. So like the surprises continue to be like, oh my God, you know, sleep deprivation and even the recovery process of sleep, that affects things going on at the cellular level that we had no idea about. Honestly, I think one of the most significant findings in our field over the last decade has been the glymphatic system, right? So sort of this waste clearance disposal system of the brain. And if you don't clear the waste in your brain by entering the most restorative stage of sleep, well, then you're setting yourself up for next day performance impairments, but also potential long-term consequences in your health, if you're, you know, talking about aspects of longevity.
What does the average person get wrong about sleep?
So I think there's two things. And again, this goes back to the like recovery of sleep, is most people don't realize that for every night of sleep loss, you need two nights of good sleep to recover that night of sleep loss. You know, that's why we know, you know, 80%, if not more, of Americans are in a state of chronic sleep debt because they don't exercise the 1-to-2 ratio. And then I think the other thing is people think that you can replace lost sleep with something like caffeine, right? It's like, oh, I didn't sleep well, so I'm going to rely on a stimulant the next day to replenish that need for sleep. No, only sleep can replace lost sleep. Biggest thing.
I see. You know, it's funny you say that because a lot of my peers, I think there's this idea of, I would say, stress competition, where, you know, as college students, you sort of pride yourself on how much more work and how much less sleep you got than the other person. Especially with pre-meds, and I'm sure pre-laws as well. I'm not very familiar with that circle. But what should college students be paying attention to in order to improve the quality of their sleep, given the current environment that we find ourselves in, where we're competing with each other based on how much less sleep we have and how much, you know, more stress we're going through?
Yeah. So I think it's no different than what I deal with, right? I work for the military, right? The community that prides itself on as little sleep as possible. And if you get sleep, you're considered weak. That culture, that mindset still exists. Like, we have actively been pushing hard to reduce that mindset, but it is still alive, prevalent, and well. And really, you break it down, the realities to them. You know, I find with a group of young men who think they're invincible, you talk about testosterone, right? Easiest way to get their attention. If you don't sleep, you don't secrete testosterone. You don't care what you say before or after that, but as soon as you start talking about testosterone, you have their complete undivided. And it, you know, goes back to the idea, we know so much about sleep and the consequences of sleep deprivation. You just have to find what fits your audience, right? In your case, learning and memory. If you don't sleep, you can't learn. You can't, you know, you're going to have to work harder and harder to try to get that A in your class, or you're going to have to try harder and harder to remember all the information that you need to in order to do well on the MCAT. It's all about knowing your audience and applying the research to that. And honestly, that's where we've had success in the military community, is even in a community that knows that there's been quite a few deaths attributed to sleep deprivation. It's the you know, talking about the impact on testosterone that has elicited the change. And, you know, now we're doing these studies to look at how levels of circulating testosterone change with sleep deprivation and military operations. And it's great. You just, you know, you have to find that why, right? Why does somebody care?
I just want to dig into that a little bit. What are the preliminary trends that you guys are seeing? How significant of the effect on testosterone is deprivation of sleep?
Oh, it's huge. So this research, honestly, it's not new. Certain podcasts where you've heard about this information, that's not new. Dr. Evonne Carter, she did this research about 24 years ago. She's at the University of Chicago. She's still an active researcher. She's amazing. Talk about amazing mentors. She's one of them. And she found that with just a single week of chronic sleep loss, meaning instead of young, healthy, college-aged males sleeping 8 hours a night, they're only sleeping 5 hours. And by day three, so within 72 hours of not getting sufficient sleep, their testosterone levels were cut in half. And they continued to decline until they got 8 hours of sleep again, where they then rose to the baseline levels. We found similar effects in the Army. When we look at switch from daytime to nighttime operations, so when we do those switches and we do training at night, you're looking at about 40 to 50 hours of full on sleep deprivation, right? Because you do the prep during the daytime, you do the night mission, and then you do the recovery afterwards, which is another 8 to 10 hours of your time before you, you know, have time to sleep. But more often than not, you're not sleeping because broad daylight out. And similar effects, like go from normal baseline levels, they decrease by about 80%. And the only way to get them back to an individual's baseline levels is through sleep.
What is the circadian rhythm and why is it important?
So that's actually a great question because that feeds into testosterone too. So when you look at most hormone secretion, production, release, it's tied to the circadian clock. We know testosterone, for example, is released at night and only at night when you sleep. And that's if you get restorative sleep. In the morning, when cortisol levels begin to rise, which is controlled by the circadian clock, increases in cortisol dampen testosterone and all those anabolic factors, right? So that's one example. The circadian clock is king. The circadian clock controls everything. You know, when you eat, how well you digest your food, when you're most active, when you're most alert, when you're less likely to get injured, when you're going to have the best sleep, when you're going to essentially learn and remember things at your best. It truly controls everything. And we know there's a clock in every single tissue of the body. My claim to fame in the field is discovering a role for the clock in the skeletal muscle and how it influences resiliency too in recovery from sleep deprivation. But there's many more clocks across the body that have a multitude of functions.
I see. You know, the top two leading causes of death within the United States are cancers and cardiac function impairment. So what is the relation between the circadian rhythm, sleep, and cardiac function?
So that's another hot topic too. Best sort of seasonal epidemiological evidence forward is the shift from falling back and springing forward. So we know there's increased risk for myocardial infarctions or heart attacks during the spring when you have that hour shift and springing forward in most of American hour sleep. And then there's actually the lowest time point for predicted myocardial infarction over the year is during the fall back when the time shift backwards and Americans have an extra hour of sleep. And you know, what's great about this data, this is looking at longitudinal assessments of risk for myocardial infarction across the U.S. population. It was published like a decade ago in the New England Journal of Medicine. So it's not like this, you know, folksy study that was published in a no-name journal. It was a huge public health effort. And so, you know, that aside from that, we know there are circadian changes in blood pressure. There are circadian changes in cardiac output. We know a lot more about this now because of commercial off-the-shelf wearables. But there are world's experts, mostly at Harvard Medical School. Frank Shear, he's a good buddy, friend of mine. He does a lot of this research.
Are there things that, you know, people can do to sort of negate the negative consequences that this shift in time can have on their cardiac function?
Yeah, so sleep and sleep banking is one of them. Just a few weeks ago, there was a report that came out that even if people aren't getting sufficient sleep on the weekdays, by sleeping in on the weekends, you can reduce your risk for heart disease by 20%. You know, we know sleep is like a bank account. The more you put in, the more you can take out. And we do have evidence to show, looking at physiology, looking at behavior, that if you allow people to sleep in prior to anticipated sleep deprivation, so, you know, you're going to bed 30 minutes, 40 minutes earlier, they have reduced decline in all those physiological and behavioral parameters during the course of sleep deprivation. So the rate of decline is much slower.
I've always wondered this because I have many friends who say they only need 5 hours of sleep to function and they feel great.
Of course. Right,
there are people who say they need 12 hours at least. So is there a link between how long you spend asleep and the quality of your sleep?
Yes, absolutely. So that's pretty much what we know and what our bread and butter is in the military, is looking at the link between sleep quality, which we define as slow wave activity, also known as stage 3 non-REM sleep, and next day performance. We know the quicker that you replenish your slow wave activity, the greater, you're going to perform the next day. So it could be, you know, these people are short sleepers genetically, and that, you know, in that 5 hour sleep opportunity, they're replenishing their need for sleep, slow wave sleep quickly. And the people who are long sleepers genetically are replenishing their need for slow wave activity very slowly. But I do like to believe that these people are just lying to themselves and that they are, you know, they just don't have good sleep habits or sleep hygiene routine. Sure, there are short sleepers and long sleepers in society, but that makes up about like 1-2% of the population from what we know from the science right now.
I see. What is chronotherapy?
So chronotherapy, in a nutshell, is essentially timing drug treatment. You can even say like physical therapy, rehabilitation treatment, essentially timing an intervention based on the circadian clock. So at what time point would we apply this therapy that it would be most effective? Again, there's a circadian, robust circadian rhythm for hormone release, for different physiological processes. So if you have, for example, a drug that's targeting, you know, androgen receptors, right? And this person is deficient in androgen receptors because of a genetic defect. Hypothetically, you would want the sustained release of testosterone or whatever androgen agent is being released from this pellet at night, right? When this person is sleeping, because that it would be compensating for this deficiency. And again, we know that testosterone release is only at night. So that's really what chronotherapy is, you know, timing the therapy with whatever the system of target is, and factoring out when to target it based on the natural circadian rhythm of that process.
Given your expertise in sleep research and sleep as a whole, what is one piece of advice you would give everyone on sleep?
I think it goes back to the thing that we know is the most prevalent, which is chronic sleep deprivation. Only lost sleep can replace lost sleep.
Like you said, it's a bank.
That's it. That would be my tagline. Like if I had a, you know, have one quote attributed to me for the rest of my career and for something I said, right, that would be passed down through generations in history books would be only sleep can replace lost sleep.
Lost sleep. I think that's a good sentence to have. Talking about peak performance, I know that you were a two-time CrossFit Games team athlete. A two-time CrossFit.
Yeah, jerseys back there.
I see. You mentioned earlier before we started your jerseys, and I know I also mentioned that I can get cameras and we can show everyone your medallia. But you are also a 2-time CrossFit regionals individual athlete and a 4-year varsity NCAA Division I athlete in track and field.
Yep.
How would you say sleep and recovery was important in your performance?
Oh, I mean, honestly, I lived for sleep, like since I was a kid. So, you know, I'm fortunate. My family, they're, you know, worked in factories. I come from a blue collar family. So they had normal 9-to-6 jobs, right? Which actually is not a bad thing because my parents actually had like really good sleep habits and they still do today in their 70s. And honestly, I think that's why, like, knock on wood, my parents are both really healthy. You know, even though my dad smokes, like he still is like otherwise very healthy. I just knew that early on. Like I knew sleep was important. I don't know. I remember it's like 3rd or 4th grade health class, right? Like our health teacher was like, oh, sleep is important. Well, growing up, I wanted to be 2 things. I wanted to be an astronaut and I wanted to be an Olympic athlete. So I was like, okay, I need to sleep. So truly from like 3rd, 4th grade on, as a gymnast growing up, I've done gymnastics at age of 3, did gymnastics through high school. In high school, I became a 2-sport athlete, did indoor, outdoor, track and field, was forced to do cross country by my track coach, to make that for 300 hurdles and all the events I did for track and field. And honestly, despite doing all those high risk sports, right, I was a level 8 gymnast. I was a pole vaulter, I was a hurdler, I was a jumper. Wow. I did that in college, right? I was a heptathlete, I was a pole vaulter. I have never had, knock on wood, like major injuries. Like, yes, I've had like a few strains and here and there, but I've never torn a major muscle that's required surgery. I've never had a herniated disc. Like, and this is about, you know, 15 years competing in CrossFit at the highest level too. And really I attribute it to sleep. Like, sleep was why I was a good athlete. Sleep is also why I was a good student. I was valedictorian of my high school, went to an Ivy League, like did all the stuff afterwards, getting a PhD and stuff. I was the lame college student who, you know, I had my roommates, not to say I was like boring, but like they knew by 10, 11 every night I was going to be in bed and I was going to sleep.
Yeah. I try to enforce the same habits as well. I usually wake up every day, like 5, gym opens at 5:30 a.m. So I'm already there and I get my workout in first thing in the morning. And by 9:30-ish to 10, that window, that 30-minute window, I try my best to fall asleep and to be already out so I can wake up the next morning and do it again.
Yeah.
But
yep.
I've always wondered how stressful is it to be that engaged and that active as a person?
So I think that it's habits, right? Like humans, we're habit forming. Like we love routine. I don't even think about it now, right? Like I travel so much with my work. It's kind of ironic, right? And I could get myself really sick. I could get myself really fat. I could like lose all my fitness completely. But it's so ingrained in me now from almost next month will be 40, almost 40 years of just every day doing the same thing, eating the same types of food. Getting in my workout, like I don't planning around trying to get 8 or 9 hours of sleep as much as I can. I don't even have to think about it. You know, I just do it.
Absolutely. I think that's the exact same for me. I mean, you know, it's at this point, it's sort of normal. I would say it's anything other than normal if I don't go at this point. So,
yeah.
But.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a double-edged sword to that though, right? It's like, I have to be really intentional about recovery days, right? Because it's really easy for me to overdo it. And then that's where when I feel overtrained or increase my risk for injury. So taking the day off, just keep going.
Mm. Did you ever make use of a mindset coach or what would you say helped you make it through all those years being that active and being that, you know, in what I would call a high stress environment? Were there any mindset tricks, any mindset coaching that you went through?
Really, I think it's it falls on my coaches and my teammates. I'm fortunate. I've always had great teammates. Like, yeah, there's been a few bad eggs over the years, but it's usually just one person, right? And that, like, even playing individual sports, like, you're still a team. And really, you know, just the strong relationships I've formed with my coaches over the years. You know, there is a big focus now on mental health. I sit on the NCAA's Mental Health Task Force to provide greater access to mental health to student athletes. That certainly was not a thing when I was growing up competing. You know, I come from that, you know, I grew up doing gymnastics. So I come from that culture of the Crowleys, right? And like how, you know, outside of what happened with Larry Nassar, but that culture of like discipline and punishment, like you get better through punishment and pushing yourself to the extreme at all times and all directions. I was fortunate in that I had coaches who didn't have that mindset, who were more balanced and, you know, who emphasized like, as long as you come here, you give 100% effort and you show up on time, like, you know, I'm going to be here for you. And I think that's where a lot of my mindset came from.
If you were to create a recipe for peak performance, what would you include in
that? That's a great question. It differs by person, right? I think knowing who you are is a big part of it. Like, yeah, sure, we have wearables and tech and like all these things to help us figure out where we are. But there's a lot that goes by like just being self-aware and of like, hey, if I work out at this time of the day, I don't feel as great as I do when I work out at this time. Or if I eat sugar at this time of the day, I don't feel as well this time. I think it just through trial and error, just like knowing what works for you and sticking to it. I mean, and more likely than not, it probably isn't attuned with your circadian rhythm. Like, for example, I knew growing up, right, I was kind of a night owl. I also, when it comes to CrossFit, I do much better during a Metcon at night than I do during the morning. I am useless during the morning. The irony being in the Army, but I also don't take positions in the Army where I have to be at work early. To no surprise, we now know from the data that people weightlift better at night because those physiological processes from norepinephrine release to epinephrine release and the recruitment of muscle fibers and the intensity of recruitment of muscle fibers is primed at night compared to the morning, no matter if you're a morning person, night person, or somewhere in between. And so that's, you know, really what it comes down to is self-awareness, is figuring out what works for you and sticking to it.
Absolutely. I think so. From my experience, you know, with other people and getting to play sports with other people, I think one misconception I've seen is one size fits all. And so, you know, everyone believes that, you know, just doing the thing the same way will yield them the same results. But to your point, which I absolutely agree with, is that, you know, it's sort of like an experiment, a self-experiment, just finding out what works best for you and implementing that.
I mean, you're not going to really get that in high school, right? Like everyone practices in the afternoon because most of the teachers in high, most of the coaches in high school are teachers, right? But when you get into college, especially if you're like play a specialty sport like I do, and even like you're playing team sport like football, right? They like there's flexibility in terms of when you go to the weight room and do your, you know, your lift. I always chose to do it after practice, not in the morning because I was useless in the morning.
The last and final question I always ask all my guests is, you know, aside from research, aside from academia, what is one message that you want to share with the world?
I think it goes back to, I'll steal this term. It's actually a title of a book by a longtime CrossFit Games coach is, you know, chase excellence no matter what it is you do. Right? Whatever purpose, whatever passion, whatever excites you to wake up in the morning, just get out there, do it, and try to be the best at it. I'm a big believer in being a master of one trade instead of a jack of all. You know, like if you're not the person who practiced 10,000 different kicks, but the person who practiced one kick 10,000 times. And I think that's, or that was not Jackie Chan, Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee said that. Yeah. So I think that's important.
That's amazing. Where is somewhere people can go to learn more about what you do?
So I do have an Instagram. I really don't use LinkedIn because I see that as like a second job and I already have a job. That's great. So it's Instagram is docjockzzz, docjockzzz. I don't really use Twitter or X, but Instagram. And then, pitch for my book. So I have a popular science book called Meathead, Unraveling the Athletic Brain. It was published over a decade ago now. It's more or less one of the first popular nonfiction books on the benefits of exercise for brain health and sort of how the brain of an athlete is unique and how it shapes into what athletes can become, rising from the ranks of amateur and what happens within their brain as they grow up to become elite athletes.
Awesome. Thank you very much. This was amazing. I really enjoyed sitting with you and learning from you.
Yeah, absolutely.